Geekscape.com. The Negro Problem, Part 2. Increased mental stamina undoubtedly accrued to the southern Negro from race intermixture, in spite of the sinister circumstances under which a race intermixture went on. Owing, however, to the mutual reserve to which we have just alluded, this benefit is fast disappearing. Everywhere, at the South, except in cities where, for obvious reasons, sexual commerce between whites and blacks is not followed by the same social penalties, the Negro is unmistakably breeding back to the original African physiognomy, and unless this process of retroversion is checked, the event must be most disastrous to the average intelligence of the black race. Worse still, not only has the new regime unsettled the Negro in all his economic relations by withdrawing him from the dominion of the authority that in some form or other is indispensable to his economic value, not only has it imparted superadded energy to his reactionary tendencies by isolating him from every kind of refining contact with the white race and throwing him back upon his primordial type, but as a further effect of his emancipation from authority and the habits of subjection that authority created, it has stimulated his grosser nature into full activity. Without the exaggeration of local pride, it may be said that the simile of Lucas in the verse is so dear to every southern heart, as violets our virgins pure and tender, simply expresses in a poetic form the deep-seated deference for womanhood that only less than the virtue of its objects renders crimes against female chastity exceptionally rare at the South among the whites. Yet surely, of all contradictions, it is one of the most ghastly that in this very community a white woman does not dare to leave unattended the curtilage of her house for fear that the libidinous hand of a bestial savage may be laid upon her. If a Negro is killed in a brawl, there are always Jacobins like Senator Chandler, drunk with the wild riot of their own evil passions, to stigmatize the entire southern people as murderers. Yet there is not one of these men who does not know, silent as they are on the subject, that scarcely is a morning newspaper laid upon a breakfast table in the Union that does not narrate a nameless outrage, all but peculiar to the Negro, followed, it is true, invariably, by the keen and swift vengeance that, under the sense of astringent necessity, however mistaken, has almost supplanted legal procedure in such cases, but too often perpetrated under circumstances of sickening atrocity. This subject is one from which even the cold eye of philosophical disquisition shrinks, but nothing better illustrates than offences of this sort, sternly redressed as they are, not only what a thoughtless thrall to his momentary appetites the Negro is, but how much the difficulty of dealing with him is likely to increase as years go on. So much for one of the two antagonistic races. Should sectional passion and party lust succeed in placing the destinies of the South under the control of this race while it remains what it is at this hour, then well might the Southern people exclaim, with a profounder significance than the poet ever dreamed, "Black is the badge of hell, the hue of dungeons and the scowl of night." And what of the other race? There is no need of a detailed comparison. It is enough to say that it is in substance the Anglo-Saxon race, the race that has asserted its inborn dignity and power under every constellation of the heavens, and in the sublime language of Edmund Waller, has trod with a steady foot, even upon the billows of the sea, the race of reformed religion and its purified altars, the race of home and its sweet tranquil joys, the race of representative institutions and constitutional restraints, the race of colonization and battle, the race of letters, invention, industry and commerce, the one race that has proved itself capable of reducing human infirmity to the wedded sway of liberty and law. In England, it has produced Shakespeare and Milton, Marlborough and Wellington, Pitt and Gladstone, Arkwright and Stevenson. In the northern states of the Union, it has produced Emerson and Hawthorne, Grant and McClellan, Franklin and Webster, Morse and Edison, and it is no idle vaunt to say that Washington, Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Henry, Jefferson, Madison, Marshall, Calhoun, Davis, and the people and the civilization of which they were the flower, will for all time attest that the blood of this race has lost none of its energy when mixed with a smaller infusion of foreign elements than anywhere else in the United States. It starts out on its circuit from the southern heart. These are the two races that constitute the population of the South. It is important to bear in mind that they are not simply distinguished from each other by vivid contrasts, physical, moral, and intellectual, but are jealously divided from each other in all the personal relations of life by a relentless caste founded upon the contrasts. This is true even of the North. Although nowhere in that section is the Negro sufficient in numbers to be a source of immediate political danger, or to make the friction of his presence generally felt in the ordinary round of daily existence. If it were not so, why is it that the Negro manifests such a strange reluctance about crossing Mason and Dixon's line, only a few hours away, and taking up his residence in communities where the old barriers of dislike and disqualification have long ago been torn down? No one needs an answer to this question who subscribes to a northern newspaper, let alone all other sources of popular knowledge. It is because the Negro has learnt for himself what prominent representatives of his race have publicly declared again and again, that he does not escape race bias by going northwards, and that if the instinctive disfavour of the whites there is not displayed towards him in all the various phases that it is at the South, or so quickly under provocation as it is at the South, it is because the spaces between his elbows and theirs are wider, and he is too weak numerically to be a menace to order and property. All the same, the disfavour exists, deep-seated, intuitive, ready at any moment to break out into angry inflammation. Northern legislatures do not pass laws requiring separate coaches for white and black passengers on railroad trains. What southern state would do it if a white man could board a train within its borders and find a Negro face here and there only to invite his listless curiosity? Northern legislatures do not pass laws against miscegenation. What southern state would do it if it knew that even though race repellency were to cease and the two races were to attract each other, it could swallow down its black infusion like a dose of nauseous medicine at a single gulp and with a single wry face? It is not until diseases of the body politic are felt or apprehended throughout its entire sensitive area that the vis medicatrix legum is invoked. So long as fond theories of human relationship, potently seductive in all their utopian forms to human optimism, can be preserved with impunity in any event, however remote, there is not likely to be a call for the political physician. But it is unquestionably true that the Negro at the North is exposed to a race proscription differing only in kind and degree from that to which he is exposed at the South. As long ago as 1880, there were nearly 500,000 of Negroes residing in the northern states. In some of these states, they and their increase now hold the balance of political power. How comes it, then, we may ask, the sublime moralists of the Senate chamber, who so generously maintain that God made of one blood all nations of men except the Mongolian, that no one of these Negroes is ever sent to Congress by a northern constituency? How many Negro governors, members of state legislatures, mayors, aldermen, judges, prosecuting attorneys, sheriffs, court clerks, bank presidents, railroad presidents, bookkeepers, or railroad conductors are there in the northern states? When the Postmaster General concludes that the race is entitled to a few scattered post offices, is it from the eager North that the post offices are selected, or is it from the reluctant South? Why is it that when even so talented a Negro as Frederick Douglass, who, curiously enough, in the estimation of Senator Ingalls, is greater by his Caucasian reinforcement than by his African blood, is to be provided for, he is given either an office in a disenfranchised community in the United States or a mission to a black republic? How much are Negro lawyers and doctors at the North patronized by white clients or patients? Are blacks freely admitted there to the various social and religious organizations that affect so much for this world and the next? Do they not sometimes complain that, cosmopolitan as is the city of New York, it is almost impossible for them to rent houses in that city outside of a cul-de-sac or some forbidding thoroughfare? Indeed, have not even colored clergymen been heard to allege that New Jersey hotels, usually so covetous of guests, become as secluded as nunneries when they present themselves at the door, gripsack in hand? Black policemen and firemen are not unknown in southern cities. How many are there in northern? It is a common thing for southern whites to work side by side with the Negro in the cotton and tobacco fields. How is this companionship relished when a Pittsburgh manufacturer undertakes to introduce blacks into his rolling mill? These and 1,000 other questions of like character might be put, and there is not one of them that can be honestly answered without sustaining the truth of what we have said with reference to the existence of race prejudice at the North. What is true, however, of the North is, of course, still more strikingly true of the South, for all the conditions favourable to race prejudice are in the South actively, incessantly, and ubiquitously at work. There, the line of the division runs with terrible distinctness through the entire organization of society. Intermarriage is universally or all but universally inhibited by constitutional or statutory provisions, and if it were under no legal ban, would be as effectively inhibited by custom. Sexual intercourse between a Negro man and a white woman against the will of the latter is avenged by the surest, the fleetest, and the most absolutely pitiless nemesis that ever silently and irresistibly sped to its mark. Sexual intercourse between a Negro man and a white woman with the consent of the latter is as rare as buggery, and when it does occur, awakens very much the same sensations in the superior race as that unnatural crime. A Negro never enters the house of a white person except as a menial. A white person never enters the house of a Negro except on an errand of business, mercy, or charity. Errands of the latter two descriptions were common enough while slavery lasted and are still occasionally prompted by ties then formed, but they are becoming fewer and fewer as death severs the ligaments of the past and the chasm between the rising generations of the two races steadily widens. Justly or unjustly too, as at the North, the white race has settled down to the conviction that the Negro is unfitted for any but the ruder vocations, and if he transcends the limits of these vocations, he must expect to secure his patronage solely from his own people. Go into a public schoolhouse where white children or white youths are taught, and there is not a black face there. Go a few blocks or a few miles further into a public schoolhouse where black children or black youths are taught, and there is not a white face there, unless it be that of the teacher, and the black race is not more anxious than the white to everywhere displace him with a black substitute. Enter a church of the one or the other race, and the same phenomenon greets the gaze. The galleries in the churches of the whites, which were once set aside for the blacks, have long ago been abandoned by them to cobwebs and dirt daubers. If a white person enters a church of the blacks, then the strident voice of the preacher is floating out over the fields, and the old men are groaning and rocking their bodies to relieve their repressed emotions, and the women are shrieking and swooning like pythonesses, and all the other concomitants of the nervous disorder that passes on such occasions for religion are fully developed. The sudden lull in the excitement and sidelong glances will easily enable him to judge how far he is wanted. At the country store, the railroad station, and the voting precinct, the blacks gather in one group, and the whites in another, set over against each other, like two warring chemical elements that may at any moment unite in an explosion. At the voting precinct, of course, the antithesis is most glaring. To one side of the ballot box stands the mass of black voters, sullen or light-hearted, accordingly as the last flaw of their mercurial temperament blows them about, demanding in silence more expressive than any words that the human lips ever syllabled, the money or the civil institutions of the rival race. To the other stands the mass of white voters, firm, self-centred, tense as the single cool man that walks with a cocked pistol in one hand and his life in the other. And so with every other point of proximity between the two races, for there is no contact but collision. In some of the southern states, if a Negro purchases a railroad ticket, he must find a seat in the cars or compartments reserved for him. In others, where for reasons in no wise suggested by relaxing prejudice, he is not under this necessity, unless he desires to gratify race enmity, he instinctively seeks the side of another Negro. Theatres and hotels are practically closed to him. Let him enter a circus, the one place of amusement to which he is addicted in common with the whites, and the tier after tier of unrelieved black countenances ascending to the roof of the tent, opposite to the tier after tier of unrelieved white, tells him that an unrelenting law of the human heart has fixed his place. Occupying the same soil, sustaining to each other, usually the relation of employer and employee, or of landlord and tenant, nearly equal in numbers, dreadfully unequal in intelligence and morale, the two races are as far removed from each other in sympathy and mutual interest as if they were inhabitants of different countries. And mark how radical and invincible the antagonism is. That the race line should be thus drawn. It is not necessary that the Negro should be a full-blooded black, or even closely approximate that character. partus sequitur ventrum alike applies to him, whether he is an unmitigated African or has just enough African blood in his veins to crisp his hair or to lend a faint saffron tint to his cheek. In either event, there is between him and the white race a great gulf cast. The mulatto may formulate, and does formulate, his distinctions too, but they receive no recognition on his paternal side. And it is but sober truth to assert that the caste underlying this state of things has simply been confirmed by the abrupt elevation of the Negro to citizenship. If the Negro had merely been manumitted, and had then been exclusively turned over to the wisdom and justice of the southern whites, he would most assuredly have been the victim of temporary oppression. The transmitted ideas of the slave era, the bitterness of the recent struggle, the character of the Negro himself would have rendered any other result impossible. But if the southern whites had come to the conclusion that the Negro was destined to be a permanent element in their corporate life, they would, as the reconciliation of the sections advanced, and the appeal to their generosity and fairness became stronger and stronger, have devised a modus vivendi between the races that would have been the offspring of their own free will and experience, and would therefore have afforded a solid and stable earnest of liberal modifications, as the Negro indicated his title to them. Forever barred from a return to slavery by a change in the organic law of the land, convinced from their own observation that it was better even for themselves that the Negro should be a free man than a slave, compelled by the necessities of their position. Maugre every backward leaning, to deal wisely and justly with him, their own enlightened self-interest, animated by the clear-sighted and conservative spirit of local self-government, would have slowly accorded to the Negro every privilege that he deserved. In this way, the excesses of the Reconstruction period and its frightful admonitions, so destructive of all confidence in the Negro as a citizen and a voter, might have been avoided. Fate, however, deemed otherwise. By three or four tremendous strokes of the pen, partly directed by genuine humanitarianism and honest zeal for abstract rights, and partly by a disinterested purpose to harmonize the new conditions at the South with what was thoughtfully believed at the time to be for the best interests of the whole Republic, but far more by the passionate suggestions of the late conflict, the slave was, through the entirely external instrumentality of a conqueror, made in every outward respect the political co-equal of his recent master, an act so utterly inconsistent with every principle of practical statesmanship, and so obviously but the refinement of a constitutional age upon the old sequels of subjugation, that the southern people had little resentment to expend upon the subsequent attempts of the national legislature to make the same slave their social co-equal as well. Thus conferred, the political equality of the Negro has served only to intensify his social inequality. Pinned upon the white race by an extraneous power, utterly without regard to their wishes, they could not but feel that it was little else than another badge of conquest, all the more hateful because not affixed by the mailed hand of the warrior, but by the sleek attorney hand of legislative oppression, guided by the cool, calculating machinations of the committee room. The consequence is that finding themselves debarred from denying one form of equality beyond their control, they have all the more jealously denied others within their control. What the Negro has gained in political privileges, he has lost twice over in social. The freer his access to the poles, the more difficult has become his access to all the human relations that law cannot reach. In the normal progress of a despised race, the political standing always precedes the social. But whatever hopes of social advancement the Negro might have justly based upon a citizenship conceded by the people with whom his lot was cast, after he had demonstrated his right to it, he cannot well base such hopes upon a citizenship granted him by the arbitrary fiat of a third party at a time when he could not, as he did not, fail to exhibit as slight credentials to political as to social preferment. Nor should the listener forget here that the race prejudices of the whites are heartily returned by the blacks. The white man does not more cordially despise the black man than the black man hates the white man. In Haiti, no white person can own an inch of soil, or indeed obtain any footing, but that of bare toleration. In the same island, Sir Spencer St. John once heard a Negro advocate pleading before a black jury defend a member of his race who had murdered a white on the grounds that it was only one white the less. So at the South, there are abundant evidences that if the Negro but had the power, he would not lack the proscriptive spirit. Every year of the Reconstruction era saw him more impatient of white leadership and more disposed to take the reins into his own hands. On the eve of an important election, it is a common habit in parts of the South for Negroes to assemble in the recesses of the forest at night for the purpose of giving expression to sentiments and aims so congenial with the hour and place that they are still reflected in the morose faces and averted eyes that are noted by the planter or overseer the next day. An ordinary arrest in a Negro quarter in a southern city, even for a crime committed within the view of the officers, often brings the whole vicinage about his ears. As a rule, of course, the animus is revealed only in the covert and indirect forms, characteristic of acknowledged inferiority, for the Negro knows that the blood runs near the skin of the white race, and as yet he cannot altogether shake off the spell of the conscious mastery that is familiar with every weak spot in his moral and mental constitution, and that responds with a ready rebuke to every encroachment upon its reservations. Still, as he recedes further and further from under the direct influence of the whites, his port becomes more and more aggressive. Now, he will content himself with visiting social ostracism, or even corporeal injury, upon the black, who has had the courage, when race feeling was running high, to vote the Democratic ticket. But then again, on another occasion, when separate tables of the same quality have been provided for the two races by a steamboat company, some Afro-American will clamorously insist upon eating with the white passengers. Again, the same heady presumption will induce a negress to throw herself down with a defiant gesture into a vacant place in a railroad car besides an unprotected white female. Again, on still another occasion, when a considerable party of Negroes are in possession of a streetcar and one or more ladies are standing, the men will affect a careless ease in retaining their seats, and the women will indulge in ostentatious chatter that leaves little doubt as to the person for whom it is intended. The same uneasy sense of inferiority leads the Negro to significantly abjure Christian names and to interlard his conversation with the prefixes of the post office and the visiting card. Pretensions like these the white race might well dismiss with a shrug or a laugh. Unfortunately, however, Race antagonism assumes far more threatening aspects.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.